and have enough money to pay the mortgage, keep the lights on, pay for her car, and buy Christmas presents. I remember sitting at her piano making up a song called Slim Jim Christmas. It's going to be a Slim Jim Christmas everywhere you go, I sang as my mother played accompaniment. We had to laugh at the situation. We had to make fun of it, or else the gloom would have been too much to bear. The irony is that my mother's annulment papers finally showed up in the mail the very next day after my stepfather left. She would finally be able to get married in the Catholic Church. The only problem was that her husband was gone. I don't know if that's divine intervention exactly, but it's something. The second time their relationship ended wasn't as easy as the first time, back when my stepfather just took off and I didn't hear from him for a year. This time he had adopted me. He had parental rights. My mother and stepfather were trying to decide visitation. Because their divorce wasn't amicable, we all wound up in family court. I was about 12, and I was called to testify about whether I wanted to see my stepfather or not. I had to go to court about 3 days in a row in the summertime in Lawrenceville, Georgia. I sat next to my grandmother on those hard wooden benches in that hot, stuffy courtroom. I just felt sick to my stomach the whole time. I kept asking my grandmother, "Can we leave now?" But no, we couldn't. I heard too many adult things in that courtroom, hurtful, spiteful language. My mother was talking about what a bad husband my stepfather had been, and then he was saying the same sort of things about my mother. It was all that tit-for-tat bullshit. I realize now it was not necessary to put a child in the middle of a divorce like that. Making a little girl sit on the stand and be questioned was cruel. I didn't want any part of it. Not on my mother's side and not on my stepfather's side. To this day, I don't appreciate it. I was sick to my stomach with anxiety being in that courtroom. Decades later, when I first started to accompany my husband Tom to court, I would become nauseated. In the deep recesses of my brain, I always equate the courthouse with that awful feeling I had during those visitation disputes. When it was all settled, I was scheduled to have visits with my stepfather. He'd gotten an apartment, and I would go hang out with him there. We would go to the movies and stuff. It wasn't bad. It was just different. He was a good dad, never mean to me, so I'm not sure why I wanted to stop going to see him. There are some holes in my memory from back then, and this is one of them. Even Renee doesn't remember the specific reason. When I told my mother that I no longer wanted to go, she asked her lawyer for advice. He said that the next time my stepfather picked me up, I could just go out in the driveway, look him in the eye and say, "I'm not coming," and then come back into the house. That was supposed to be good enough. The next time he came for me, I saw his car pull up. I walked outside. My mother was at home, but she was upstairs putting on her makeup. She figured I would deliver my lines as discussed, and everything would end peacefully. My grandmother Anne's sister, my great-aunt Helen, was standing by the window, watching me walk out there to say, "I'm not coming." She had a feeling it wasn't going to be as easy as Renee assumed. After I told him I didn't want to come, my stepfather got out of the car and tried to take me. "Renee, he's got her," Helen yelled to my mother. Helen and Renee came running out to stop him, and my mother tried to pull me away from him. My mother had one of my arms, and my stepfather had the other. They were literally having a tug of war with me. I wrapped my feet around the railing leading up to the front porch and started crying. It was a spectacle, and all the neighbors could see this scene unraveling in the front yard. It was just trashy. My mother jumped onto my stepfather's back and started scratching him. Finally, he let me go. When he snatched me, it's like something in him had snapped. He was angry at my mother and wanted to see his little girl, and he was just enraged and frustrated. Finally, he came back to his senses, and he dropped the whole thing. After that, I had to go see a child psychologist. Eventually, the court said that I no longer had to visit my stepfather if I didn't want to. I didn't see or speak to him again for a long time. In fact, the next time I spoke to him was in 1989, just after my mother and I moved to New York. I was 18 at the time, and my grandmother found out that my stepfather's parents were both killed in a tragic car accident. She was really good about reaching out to people in times of crisis. She called my stepfather's sister, who told my grandmother that when they went through her mother's possessions, my step-grandmother still had my picture in her wallet. As I reminisce on this story, I feel really terrible about that. There was so much sadness around that whole part of my life, and I wonder why she kept that photo all those years. After my grandmother told me that news, I thought I should reach out to my stepfather and give him my condolences. When he picked up the phone, I could hear noise in the background, like he had people over or there was a party going on. I told him how sorry I was about his parents' death and asked him how he was doing, but he was hesitant to reply to me. I could almost feel him on the other end of the line, looking around the room and trying to find a way out of the conversation. "Erica," he finally said, "I prefer if you didn't contact me again." "Oh, okay," I replied, a little stunned. "Take care." That was the last time I ever spoke to him. I was sad that he wasn't happy to hear from me. Perhaps I was expecting too much, but looking back on it, I think I understand why he felt that way. We'd always had a good relationship. I still think fondly of our time together riding around in one of his many cars, going to a sporting event, or even just helping him run his errands around town. But he was already dealing with the heartache of his parents dying. The last thing he needed was this charged interaction on top of it. I think his rejection had more to do with his relationship with my mother. They still had hard feelings for each other. Hearing from me, I think, just reminded him of that pain, so I respected his wishes and never called again. As for Nicholas, my biological father, I never tried to contact him. My mother and grandmother would tell me stories to fill in the blanks. When I was being really bad, my mother would say, "Ugh, you're just like your father," which at the time meant nothing to me. I didn't feel the need to have a relationship with him. I had grown up very close to my grandfather Hollis, who was the one who would give me away at my first wedding. I'd also had a few good years with my stepfather. That was enough. I was satisfied. My Uncle Alejandro, however, had different ideas. Aunt Janet was long divorced from Uncle Gabriel, but she was still in touch with both my mother and Alejandro. He wanted things to be right between my father and me. He asked Janet if I would be interested in speaking with my father on the phone. Janet had my mother ask me, and I agreed. Through that complicated phone tree, we worked it out. I was almost 25. I had already been married and divorced and was living with my mother and 4-year-old son in Tudor City in Manhattan. To be honest, that first phone call was a little awkward. I was talking to someone whom I had heard about my entire life, someone who was obviously instrumental to my even being on this planet, but I really knew almost nothing about him. We played catch-up on our lives and talked about where we were and what we were doing. I told him everything about myself. He confirmed that when he left Atlanta, he moved to Oakland, California, and became a police officer. He was still working on the force. He was remarried and had a small daughter who was younger than my son. I was planning to visit Janet, who was living in West Hollywood by that time, in a few months. So my father and I arranged that when I got to the West Coast, I would meet him in person. Janet lived right across the street from the Le Parc Hotel. It's a cool rock and roll hotel that's always been one of LA's hidden gems. He stayed at the hotel, and I walked across the street and met my father in his room. I always thought that I looked a lot like Renee, but as soon as I met him, I realized it is my father who I really look like. I have full lips, big bushy eyebrows just like him. On my mother's side, I come from a long line of towheads with icy blue eyes. I'm the only one with green eyes like my father. I'm also the only one with an ass. I have my father to thank, or maybe his mother, for giving me that blessing. I shook his hand, and he gave me a bracelet. It was a big, thick rope of gold. And when I got back to New York, I immediately pawned it to some Hasidim in the Diamond District to pay the rent. They gave me around $1,200, so I can only imagine how much it was really worth. There wasn't that Hallmark movie moment where I saw him, I shouted, "Oh, Daddy," and ran into his arms, and we were suddenly best friends. There was none of that. It was very businesslike. What exactly do you say? We went out for the day. I drove Janet's stick shift around town, and he told me, "You drive like a man." It's the only compliment my father ever gave me. I forget exactly what we were doing. No matter the activity, what we were really doing was feeling each other out. As sad as it sounds, we were just two strangers getting to know each other. This is when I learned about my grandparents and my father's childhood in El Salvador. I learned about the shed behind my grandfather's house and the unknown branches of my family tree. At the end of our visit, he invited me to come stay with him and his family in the Bay Area for Thanksgiving, which I accepted. A few months later, I arrived. He picked me up from the airport, and I went to his townhouse outside Oakland. I met his wife, Bridget, who was very sweet, and his adorable young daughter, Fallon. "Let me show you what I do and show you around," he said. We drove to the police station in downtown Oakland, and he introduced me to his co-workers as his daughter. "Oh, that's funny," more than one person at the station said. "We've never heard of you before." Then we went to the gun range, which is something all good Southern dads do with their daughters. At 25, I was finally getting my turn. At the shooting range, he told me, "If I'd raised you, you'd have been walking around with a machine gun and a machete." Little did he know, I'd been shooting guns my whole life. My grandfather kept a double-barreled shotgun next to the bed and a machete under the driver's seat of his van. Atlanta and El Salvador weren't as far apart as he thought. He also asked me, "How's your mother's weight? She's been known to fluctuate." When I got back to New York, I repeated that story to my mother. She went ballistic. "That son of a bitch! How dare he!" she shouted. "I was always small when I was with him." It was like they were 18 again and cussing each other out. He knew it was the perfect dig to get at my mother, and he knew I would tell her about it. We both played our parts, just as he figured we would. After the gun range, we went back to the house. My stepmother was in another room, and my father and I were standing in the small hallway between the kitchen and the living room. We were watching his daughter play on the thick, sandy brown carpet in front of the fireplace. She was just a happy, beautiful, blonde toddler keeping herself entertained. The house was decorated for the holidays, and it was very homey. "So, how did you end up with Fallon?" I asked my father, trying to make small talk. "Well," he said, "Bridget had never had any children before, and I never had any children before, so, you know." He quickly caught himself, realizing he'd made a massive mistake. The air became heavy, and it was incredibly silent between us. We really looked into each other's eyes and processed everything that was packed into that statement. It rolled over me all at once in a wave that made my arm hair stand on end. In his mind, I had never existed. He had erased me. I stood there in silence. I shouldn't have been so surprised, since everything in his life announced this truth. He had never reached out, and the people at the station didn't know about me. "Oh, I'm so sorry," he said, and gave me a big hug and said, "I have you now, and I'm not going to let you go." Even as he said those words, I knew the score. I knew that there was nothing here for me. Whatever I was searching for by getting to know him, it wasn't there to be found. There would be no fairy tale ending. On my father's part, that statement was an innocent mistake. And it was the innocence of his mistake that confirmed that we didn't need to have a relationship. It wasn't that he thought poorly of me. He didn't think of me at all. We got through the rest of the weekend. My father and my stepmother were perfect hosts. They were really trying hard, but I knew this experiment in a new relationship was doomed. When I got back to New York and told Renee about what happened, she got a little angry and said, "I'm sorry." She gave me a hug. It felt like a favorite blanket. "I'm not surprised something like that happened," she said. She knew much more of my father's history than I did. She was more disappointed by the news than I would ever be. Nicholas called a few times after that, but our communication petered out. Neither of us tried very hard to pursue it. To this day, my son Thomas has never met him, even though they have so much in common. My son's a police officer in California, just like my father was. They probably never will meet. The day I turned 40, I remembered turning to my husband, Tom, and saying, "Do you think my father thinks of me on special days like today?" "There's no good in even asking that question," Tom said. That was absolutely the right answer. It wasn't yes or no. It was, that kind of thinking isn't going to make your life better. I don't hate men. I don't blame men for the way I was treated by my father. I don't think that I have an older husband now because I needed a dad, even if that's a temptingly easy suggestion. I love having someone who really knows his shit and has an incredible brain. Tom's age alone doesn't account for those qualities. Many of the men I've been in relationships with have been much closer to my age. My first husband was older than me, but only by 7 years. The fact that Tom is 33 years older is not my blueprint. It's just how things happened to shake out the one time everything else clicked. I don't think the father figures who let me down are bad people. They were doing the best they could, and sometimes that's just not enough. It's less their fault than it is circumstances they were in. I can't really blame them for what happened. Now I'm so far away from these issues, it doesn't hurt anymore. In those moments, it was excruciating, but you can't stay in that pain for too long. You have to let it wash over you and pass, or it will drown you. I also have to be mindful that these rejections don't make me hard-hearted. It can be difficult to trust other people. I'm always waiting for the other shoe to drop, like someone could walk out of my life at a moment's notice. But I have to evolve beyond that mindset. I have to transcend these people and the pain they brought me. I have to keep walking forward. I have to do the best that I can and hope that everything I've learned from these men helps me do things better than they did. Chapter 4, So Hot It Burns. When Tom and I fly our Gulfstream to New York City, we land at Teterboro Airport. It's just across the Hudson River from Manhattan in Bergen County, New Jersey. Like most airports, it's not necessarily in the most glamorous part of town. If Manhattan is the city that never sleeps, this is the stretch of Jersey that passes out in the gutter. As our car pulls out of Teterboro toward Manhattan, we turn down a service road that looks like it's definitely seen a body or two disposed of in the past. On that road, right across the street from the airport, is a square, white, rundown building sitting in the corner of a parking lot. This is Shakers, one of New Jersey's infamous go-go bars. In New Jersey, clubs that feature nudity can't also serve alcohol. To get around this law, there are many go-go clubs and bikini bars. Girls dance wearing as little as they can while still keeping it legal for guys to unwind with a beer after work. There are several of them near Teterboro, but Shakers loomed large because of its visibility right across the street. I felt unsettled every time Tom and I drove past it because it was like a ghost from the past. Once upon a time, a whole lifetime ago, I was one of those girls shaking it at Shakers. Tom knew vaguely about this particular bullet point in my resume, but we'd never discussed it in detail. I certainly never told him about any of the clubs I'd worked in or what it was like. It's not a time in my life I'm fond of recalling. After I graduated from Northside High in Atlanta, my mother and I both moved to New York City on October 1st, 1989. I knew I needed to be in the big city where there were more opportunities to get my start as an entertainer. For Renee, it was the perfect excuse to leave her old life and disappointments behind. She quit her job in the mortgage industry and got another job in Manhattan doing the same thing at a different bank. Renee was always an artist working on paintings and teaching piano. She wanted more for her life than just raising a kid in Atlanta. She would say, "Erica needs to leave and I need to be there because she can't do anything by herself." What she really meant was she wanted to leave just as bad as I did. We were living at 215 West 84th Street and Broadway on the Upper West Side. It's a nice doorman building where Edgar Allan Poe used to have a farmhouse. So it was a pretty cool spot. We lived in a spacious one-bedroom apartment that had a loft over the kitchen. Renee got the bedroom and I slept in the loft. For those unfamiliar with the quirks of New York City apartments, there was a little ladder in the living room that went up to a platform that was over the kitchen, but the open part of the loft looked out onto the living room. You couldn't stand up in it, but it was big enough for my bed and my artwork on the walls. There were no fights over closet space because I barely owned anything. Just a leather jacket, a few pairs of jeans, and dancewear. I wasn't a fashionista back then. I was broke. I had no connections in New York, but I did have a couple of high school friends who moved up there to pursue their dreams. We were all 18 to 20, and we didn't know shit. Just like every other theater kid, I was just trying to live out some would-be dream of being in show business. I just wanted to perform. I just wanted to get a job doing what I was trained to do, singing, dancing, and acting. It's like that line from The Music in the Mirror in A Chorus Line. Give me somebody to dance for. Give me somebody to show. Let me wake up in the morning to find I have somewhere exciting to go. While I was taking the subway all over town to auditions, I still needed to make some cash. My mom was 36 and trying to start fresh. She told me, "You're 18, pay rent or get out." And she meant it. Our rent was not cheap, especially for an 18-year-old with more promise than income. My girlfriend Justine had graduated from Northside before me and immediately moved to New York. When I got to town, she became my best friend, and we were inseparable, hanging out, preparing for auditions, and going to all the clubs we could charm our way into. We were both broke, but Justine had it even harder than I did. At least I had my mother in case things got really bad. Justine only had herself. I've always admired her because she went through a lot on her own. I don't know if I could have done the same without Renee. This was 1989, before Mayor Giuliani showed up with his magic wand and Disney-fied large swaths of New York. Justine's apartment was on the far Upper West Side, and the stroller set was still a good decade from showing up and transforming the place. Justine's apartment had been recently renovated, so it was nice inside. When I would spend the night, I would sleep on what we called the San Francisco futon because it had lumps as big as hills. But the neighborhood was trouble, and she got robbed a lot. It looked a bit like that movie New Jack City, where there were just empty lots all around and some of the buildings were condemned. You could hear gunshots daily. It was that rough. We were both incredibly broke, riding the subway to all of our auditions and subsisting on grilled cheese sandwiches and dollar slices of pizza when we could afford them. One day, Justine said to me, "Erica, I have a dancing job for us." I was like, "Okay, what is it?" "It's kind of like the movie Flashdance. You can perform and you wear something that resembles a swimsuit. It's like a cross between that and a nightclub," she said. "And it's in New Jersey, right outside the Holland Tunnel." "What are you talking about?" I asked. It seemed too crazy to be true and, well, not exactly how I was looking to start my career as an entertainer. But Flashdance was one of my favorite movies. "Just come with me. It's going to be fine and we'll make some cash." One Friday night, we took the subway from her apartment down to Port Authority and then rode the bus out to New Jersey. This, in itself, was a treacherous journey. I remember avoiding the rats on the subway platform, and every time I got out of the Port Authority with my life, I said a little prayer of thanks. The first club I worked in was called The Palace in Passaic, New Jersey. It was located in a narrow limestone building like you might find on an old-fashioned New England main street. There was a small window in the facade with a busted mannequin wearing hideous lingerie. It was creepy and sad. This was not the glamorous life I had imagined for myself. I thought, this is so gross. What am I doing here? Looking back on it, I think Justine just wanted someone to tag along with her because she hated it so much. Sometimes you had to go by yourself, and it was depressing as hell. At least if there were two of you, there's someone to complain to, and it's not as scary and lonely. When I arrived, I met Gino, the guy who owned the club. He was wearing a cream-colored cashmere overcoat and had a gray John Gotti-style blowout. He wore a pinky ring, drove a white Mercedes, and always seemed to be taking cash out of the register. He could have been a character in Goodfellas. Justine took me up to the dressing room and gave me one of her outfits to wear. It was a cobalt blue Brazilian bikini. That was a hot thing in these clubs back then. Basically the smallest bikini you could find with tiny ties on the side and little triangles of fabric for the top. When we got there, Justine told me to call her Justice. She felt like it had a little bit more exotic flair than just Justine. She was trying to create a more glamorous stage persona. I just went by Erica. At the Palace, like most of the bars, the girls would dance for 30 minutes and then have 30 minutes off. As we waited upstairs, the DJ would try to get people to stay by announcing over the broken, crackling PA which girls should be ready. If they knew that fresh faces and fresh everything else would be out soon, maybe they'd stick around for another drink. The DJ would say, "Erica, 5 minutes. Veronica, 5 minutes. Robin, 5 minutes. To this day, I still laugh thinking about it. Most of the bars were set up the same way. A square bar in the middle of the room with a square stage in the center of the bar. As we were dancing on the stage in our bikinis, a well where the bartender stood plus the bar itself kept the patrons off of us. Though many might want to call it one, this wasn't a strip club. There were no lap dances or glamorous champagne rooms or anything like that. This was just dancing in a micro bikini and talking to the guys, all blue-collar dudes after work for their extra singles. At the end of the night, we'd have to cash in those dollar bills with the bartender to take home larger bills. The first time I did it, I felt fucking insane. I was wearing this blue bikini, which seemed like it should feel familiar. It was just slightly smaller than the leotards and dance costumes I've been performing in most of my life. But I knew that my goal here was to hustle money, and that made it feel scandalous. This wasn't even as fabulous as being a stripper for real. I was just dipping my foot into the baby pool. There are girls at 18 living in Vegas and working at the Spearmint Rhino making boatloads of cash. I mean, I wish it had been something exciting like that, but none of that was happening in suburban New Jersey. The other girls and I weren't that caliber of talent. We weren't the women who allegedly make 5 to 10 grand a night at some upscale strip club. It just wasn't that place, didn't have that clientele, and couldn't draw that level of talent because there wasn't the audience for them. Don't get me wrong, I looked cute. I weighed 118 pounds and had a lean dancer's body. This was way before my boob job, so I was small and natural. I looked like this little tomboy running around in a bikini. It was a marketable look, to say the least. The first night I got on stage, Justine told me to just watch her and figure it out. I didn't know if I was supposed to do choreography or what. I had no clue what I was doing, but she'd let me know if I was missing signals for guys to tip me or if I was hanging out in the well of the bar too long, which Gino didn't like. I had no clue. I was just trying to pay the rent so I could go out and audition one more time. When the club closed at 3 a.m., I had a few $100 more in my backpack than when we started. Considering this was the 80s in Jersey, it wasn't bad for a first night. The Palace had that gross bar smell of cigarettes and stale beer. It was set up like a saloon, a long room with very high ceilings. For some reason, there were multicolored streamers and half-inflated balloons along the ceiling, like a perpetual New Year's Eve party gone wrong. We would stink when we left because back then the customers were allowed to smoke indoors. The stench would get in our hair. The lighting wasn't particularly flattering either, with blue and pink lights hitting us from above. They tried to make the atmosphere sexy and have us look our best, but when you're in a club that smells of cooking grease and day-old Newports, there's not much you can do about the mood. As far as dancing itself goes, I was pretty good once I figured it out. When you take as many dance classes as I did growing up, you learn how to control your body. Not necessarily in a sexual way, but it is feminine. Combine that with knowing how to captivate an audience and keep it engaged, which I learned from performing, and I figured I had a pretty good recipe for getting these guys' attention. I would always have to beg the DJ to play dance music or house music, anything with a beat I could actually dance to. Otherwise, it'd be lots of New Jersey hairband rock. Bon Jovi, Def Leppard, Poison, Whitesnake. And that stuff is impossible to dance to. All you can do is whip your hair around and pretend you're in the Hot for Teacher video. I started doing these clubs 2 nights a week, on Fridays and Saturdays, because that was all I could handle. Those were the good nights when you could make the most money. There was a little circuit of all these clubs, and I would find out from other girls which ones were hot, where you could make money, which ones were slowing down, and where the action was. It was then up to me to make connections at those clubs and try to get booked there. I went all over from Secaucus to Newark and everywhere in between. These clubs had names like Shakers, Buns, The Palace, AJ's, or the Naval Base. The Naval Base was actually seized by the feds at some point when I was making the rounds, and no one ever went there again. I danced once at Satin Dolls in Lodi, New Jersey, which is where they shot the scenes in The Sopranos set at Bada Bing. Shakers burned down at one point. After they rebuilt it, they sold shirts that said, "Shakers, so hot it burns." Yeah, it was that cheesy. Some of the girls who worked in the club had a side business where they would make tiny outfits and Brazilian bikinis. One girl had a company called Itsy Bitsy, and I bought a bunch of different outfits from her. At the end of a shift, I'd fork over $100 of the money I just made and walk out with new outfits. A fluorescent orange one, a royal blue one, and a sheer black one that made me look like Apollonia or one of those other Prince girls from the 80s. The aesthetic was very much big hair, deep tans, denim jackets, and all those cliches you can think of. Basically, everybody looked like Snooki, even though she hadn't been born yet, and was hosed down in a sticky sweet candy apple scented body spray. I thought of a strategy to make myself stand out, which is how I would make all my tips. I had long, straight, blonde hair all the way down my back. I kept my alabaster skin natural, and I would wear bright red lipstick. While all the other girls wore pumps or stilettos, I would wear sexy ankle boots with high heels. Today, I perform in over-the-knee boots, so it's basically the same idea. One of the biggest lessons I learned is that not every man likes the same thing, and this fact applied to me. Blondes with a southern twang don't always win. I would walk up to a guy thinking he was going to give me the cash, but no. He only liked redheads, or he only liked black girls, or he wanted someone with a fuller body. You never knew what they were going to want just by looking at them. Most of the customers were really nice people, but not the kind who were going to help my career. I remember this one guy who would always be at the club, He had a jerry curl glistening under his captain's hat, and he would flip his dentures around in his mouth. I'd be on stage and hear this weird squishy clicking noise. I'd look over and his teeth were upside down in his mouth. That said, he was a very nice man and a great tipper. There were many times when I had guys who would pinch or pull at me while I was working. The guys could smell how naive I was, and were always trying to get close or ask me out on dates. I always said no. I never saw any illegal activity going on, but looking back, it might have been all around me. I was just too young and stupid to know what to look for. Other than the clientele, one of the worst parts of working at the club was the transportation issue. Getting there on the bus was a drag, but even worse was getting home. The buses would stop running at a certain hour, and neither of us wanted to drop half the money we made to take a cab home. It was cold as hell in the winter, and you didn't want to be hanging around outside for your ride in these sketchy New Jersey neighborhoods. You would end up a statistic. This was way before Uber, but one of the ways we would get home was this guy we called Lobotomy John. He was a freelance driver who would pick up all the girls from the clubs and drive them into the city. All the girls lived in Manhattan, trying to make it as actresses, models, or dancers, and they had to work the clubs to pay for these expensive apartments. He wasn't dangerous or anything. He was just slightly off. He had a route and would drive around to all the clubs and pick up the girls, packing four or five of them into the back seat of his Cadillac. This is usually where we would network to find out which were the good clubs for making money. Every time he'd come into the club, he'd say, "I'm going to the diner. Do you want me to bring you something?" We would say no, politely as possible. Then he'd say, "You sure you don't want a fruit cup?" Every time. It was a fruit cup. No matter what you answered, he'd say, "Do you want a fruit cup?" "No, I don't want a fruit cup," I would say in exasperation. He was just being sweet and asking if he could get us anything. But every time it was, "Do you want a fruit cup? Do you want a fruit cup?" One day, just to see what all the fuss was about, I let him get me a fruit cup. You know what? It was amazing! Just kidding. It wasn't that great. With or without Lobotomy John, getting home was always a pain in the ass. One night, Justine came up to me and said, "Hey, some friends of mine are going to take us home." These friends were a band that Justine knew from the city that coincidentally wound up at the club. She was so embarrassed. I got dressed in the dressing room and came out wearing my typical black sweatshirt, jeans, boots, and backpack. The night was over and my hair was in a ponytail, but I still had on my bright red lipstick. I met Justine in the parking lot and she said, "Oh, there they are." Up pulls this van and the door opens. The back of the van had wall-to-wall carpet and captain's chairs and shit. It looked like Bon Jovi was in there. They were like, "Yo, come on, man, get in." I was skeptical. "Are these your friends?" I asked Justine. She said, "Yeah, they're cool. They have a gig in the city. They're going to drop us off on the way." I was thinking I'd rather be eating a fruit cup with Lobotomy John than dealing with this scene. There was just something sketchy about this whole plan. They were playing music, and the vibe was just bizarre. Then the driver said, "We gotta stop by my house. I'm just going to run in and get something." We stopped at a house in typical suburban New Jersey neighborhood, where all the houses are two stories tall with aluminum siding and dead lawns, and crammed next to each other like passengers on a commuter train. Someone's girlfriend was out on the street with her friend. The driver slid back the door so his bandmates could get out, and she saw Justine and me sitting there. She screamed, "Oh, my God, I knew it! I knew it! I knew you were hanging out with strippers!" A fight broke out with the girlfriend and the driver right there in the middle of the street at 3 a.m. I was surprised the neighbors didn't call the cops, or at least shout out the window for them to shut up. "Justine, all of this so we could save $25? I asked her. The whole band got into a fight with this girlfriend and her friend. She said, "I knew you were in there with a couple of hooas." She pronounced it in that New Jersey accent of like, "Hooas." They brushed her aside and drove off with us in the back. I mean, they were very sweet, but I didn't need all this. I wanted to tell that girl, "Bitch, I'm not a whore. I'm just trying to get back to the city. I don't even want to be fucking doing this job. I hate this entire existence. I don't know these fucking people. I just want to ride home." But I didn't do any of that. I just sat in the back of this carpeted van, hugging my knees, waiting for the fight to be over so I could go home and pass the fuck out. Another night I was working at one of the clubs, and Anthony, the manager, called me to the office. He was sexy, only had one eye and rocked the hell out of an eye patch. Once the door was closed, he said to me, Erica, what are you doing? I thought I was doing a good job dancing at the club. I said to him, what do you mean, what am I doing? What are you doing here, he asked. I'm just trying to make some money to pay my rent. Why? Where's your father? I told him I don't know my father and we didn't have a relationship. You don't belong here, Anthony told me finally. At that time, I was offended and confused. But really, Anthony was my gangster angel. He knew I had more to offer than just dancing in his club. He knew I had something else to give, and I wasn't cut out for this lifestyle. I was pretty awful at this gig. I was insulted if the guys didn't give me money. I thought, come on, dude, I'm smiling. It's not a lot of money. Give it up. I never wanted to be there, so I never really put my back into it, so to speak. I got fired from a couple of places because I was such an asshole. At the palace, you had to call to confirm that you were going to work your assigned shifts. I thought that was stupid, so I wouldn't confirm. My word was my word, so if I said I was going to be there on Friday, I would be there on Friday. After warning me a few times and me getting sassy with them, they stopped booking me entirely. Can you imagine getting fired from a fucking go-go bar in New Jersey? Do you know how lazy and ill-tempered you have to get fired from a gig like that? One night, at Go-Go-Rama, one of the clubs that would hire as many dancers as they could squish onto the stage, I looked over at Justine and said to her on stage, screaming over some obnoxious music, this is a dumb concept. We have on stupid bikinis writhing around trying to get cash for the rent. This is dumb. And it was hard because there were so many girls, it was impossible to make any money. Don't get me wrong, my floor work is second to none, and if you don't believe me, watch my painkiller video on YouTube. A lot of the moves I use as Erica Jane, I perfected in New Jersey. Still, as a concept, I thought it was dumb. Go-go dancing wasn't the only moneymaker then, but it was a dependable source of income in a pinch. You knew you were going to make some money at the end of the night, and that was something. I wish I had some big dramatic story about how this stage of my life ended. How one night I was finally fired by some wannabe mafia boss who was sick of my rebellious ass. Or I was just so tired of the Port Authority, the customers flipping their dentures, lobotomy John shilling for fruit cups, and all that other bullshit we had to go through that I walked out in a blaze of glory and never looked back. But honestly, it wasn't that dramatic. I got a job cocktail waitressing at a little bar in the West Village. It was a lot easier to get to. I made about the same money, while retaining much more dignity. This was also about the time I started dating the man who would become my first husband and my son's father, so I really didn't want to be shaking it at Shakers anymore. The reason I don't like looking back on this period has nothing to do with taking my clothes off or nudity or anything like that. I still take my clothes off today, and I have no problem with it. It's not a moral judgment. I just wasn't prepared for the scene, and I was totally outmatched. I remember thinking this is how people got stuck. There was always an aura of sadness that I didn't like. There was a resignation, and I wasn't going to let it infect me. I never had much occasion to think about that time in my life until Tom and I started flying into Teterboro. Right across the street with Shakers every time. Each trip to New York, I knew there was going to be that little bit of dread. We would drive by it, and I would have to decide whether or not I was going to tell Tom my story. Finally, one day we were driving past. I decided it was time to come clean. I knew Tom loved me. This wouldn't make him think any less of the woman I had become in the decades since I finally walked out of that club. As we drove by, I said, hey, Tom, see that place over there? Immediately, he knew what was up. Is that one of the clubs where you worked? Yep, I replied somewhat bashfully. Well, we have to go. Come on, let's check it out. We told the driver to turn around and we headed for the club. Now, this was a Tuesday afternoon or something like that. Not really prime time for a New Jersey go-go bar. When we walked through the front door, I felt like I was walking into the past. Everything was the same. The square bar, the lighting overhead, the blue-collar guys drinking beer out of the same green and brown bottles. There was even the same smell, which is really what brought me back. Tom and I sat down and got drinks. We watched the one lonely day shift girl half-heartedly work the stage. She wore all white, and it glowed under the black light. The lighting also made her blonde hair glow bright yellow. She looked just like I must have when I was there. She was doing her job, but I'm sure wishing she was somewhere else. Tom asked me about how the clubs work and what I remembered about my time there. I told him the whole story. We didn't stay that long, and honestly, I was happy to leave. We got back into the car and headed off toward Manhattan. Tom reached over, grabbed my hand, and looked me right in the eye. "Look, Erica," he said. "On the bright side, it only took you 10 years to get across the street." We both burst out laughing. He was right, and I think I'm a better person for it. I've never been one to knock where someone else comes from, or what they had to do to get where they are today. It's easy for people to pass judgment. I've never liked slut-shaming or any other kind of shaming. I always want to tell people, when you're putting a dollar in a woman's bra, you have no idea whom you're tipping. You don't know what's going to happen to anyone or where they'll end up. I certainly never look down on a woman hustling to make a buck. I've been that woman, and all that hustling makes every buck even more precious. I learned the value of a dollar at Shakers. Sitting in the Gulf Stream across the street a decade later, I still knew it. That is the real lesson of money. You earn your self-worth working for those stupid dollars. I always dreamed so big that I could imagine one day having my own airplane, even though I didn't understand there was a private airport across the street from the very spot I was scrounging for tips. The old part of me is always going to be there. Shakers is always going to be greeting me every time I land at Teterboro. It's an old ghost, reaching out from the murky past. "Remember me?" it asks. I always acknowledge, "Yes, yes, I do." Chapter 5, A Playdate with Every Boy. When I was in kindergarten, I had a playdate with every boy in my class. My mother used to keep my pink, huffy Thunder Rose bike in the trunk of her car because I was always off to some boy's house after school. We would ride bikes, catch turtles, climb trees, and play in the mud. I was a bit of a tomboy, so it made sense to hang out with the boys in my class rather than the girls. But also, let's just say, I've always enjoyed the company of the opposite sex. My mom says I was flirty even as a toddler. I was really social, very open, and showered people with affection. I was always putting on the Ritz, picking out short shorts and crop tops that would fashionably express my carefree attitude. In second grade, I kissed my first boy. It was just a peck on the lips. The class was watching a movie, and one of the boys in the class and I snuck a kiss while under the desks. I never thought of myself as a pretty child. There was always someone prettier, blonder, taller in my class. I didn't think that my looks set me apart. What I did have was a comfort level with myself, which people found infectious. My first serious boyfriend was Jonathan, in high school. He was in the tech department at Northside High School, and I was in the musical theater department. Jonathan was not only hot, but incredibly bright, and always made honor roll. He had deep blue eyes and was a junior, where I was only a freshman. I think I caught his eye on one of those Northside spring break trips to Europe, and we got together at the end of that year. He was fun and a little wild, but a really great guy and treated me well. Both my grandmother and my mother loved him. I lost my virginity to him when I was 14. We were in his bedroom at his parents' house, and the Eagles Hotel California was playing on the stereo. Was that a little foreshadowing of my West Coast life to come? He wasn't a virgin, but he wanted to be a gentleman and not push me. I was ready, and I had to convince him of that. Jonathan is still a great guy, and we are in touch to this day. While Jonathan was handsome, I don't really have a physical type. I'm too enamored with male energy to really care if a guy is short or tall, blonde or brunette, hairy or smooth. I've always loved men. I love the way they smell. I love the way they taste. I love the way they feel. So physically, my relationships have been all over the map. I've had some really gorgeous boyfriends, and I've had some really nerdy boyfriends. What I'm most attracted to are intelligent, aggressive, successful men. Beautiful men are great, and God bless them, but that's not who I choose as a partner. Another similarity among men I choose is that both of my husbands are Italian. I always like to joke that I marry Italians, date Jewish boys, and for the rest, I'm gonna keep to myself. There's only one time I had a same-sex encounter. To be fair, it was more of a three-way situation. An ex-boyfriend I kept in touch with had married an acquaintance of mine. He was about 6 feet tall, muscular, educated, and professional. She was a light-skinned Caribbean beauty with golden highlights in her dark hair. They were a handsome couple. He called me and asked to go out to dinner with them on Valentine's Day. We had a great time, kind of like we were on a little date. They seemed like they were testing the waters with me and driving the conversation towards sex. He had already hinted they were into this kind of thing, so I wasn't totally shocked. I knew this might be on the agenda, and I was okay with it. We went back to their place after dinner and had quite the memorable Valentine's Day. It was a very positive experience. I had a great time with the two of them, and it satisfied my curiosity. Among all my friends, I have the most boring sex stories, but in my defense, I hang out with a bunch of libertines. I've almost always been more of a relationship type. I got married and had a child at 20, then married again at 27. Even between marriages, I almost always had a boyfriend, so I wasn't really playing the field. I enjoy having a partner. I enjoy companionship, having a best friend, all of that wrapped up into one. I met my first husband, Tom, but we'll call him Tommy to avoid any confusion with my current husband, during one of the rare single periods of my life. I moved to New York when I was 18. I was going to auditions, working, and going out to clubs in Manhattan. My high school girlfriend, Justine, and I went out like it was our job. There was one month where we didn't see sunlight at all. We'd wake up late, audition, and then go out to the club. As the sun was coming up, we'd go pass out at her place. Like a good New Yorker, I was always dressed in black. Black jeans, black top, black leather jacket. It was the late 80s and early 90s, so we were at Palladium, Larry T's Love Machine, Red Zone, Twilo, MK, The World, Sound Factory, and all the legendary superclubs. It was the era of the club kids, and one of the best times of my life. I was doing all the hedonistic partying that most kids get out of their systems in college. One of our favorites was the China Club, which had a legendary Monday night party. Back then, it was in the basement of the Beacon Hotel on 73rd Street on the Upper West Side. It became known as a cool hangout for musicians who might spontaneously stop by and play. We're talking people like Stevie Nicks, David Bowie, and Stevie Wonder. Madonna even had Thanksgiving dinner there one year. Monday night was their biggest night, and you wouldn't even get through the door if you weren't cool enough. This was the era of the door policy in New York, way before bottle service took over. Now, anyone can pay their way into a nightclub. Back then, if you didn't look right, you wouldn't get past the bouncer. The great thing about the China Club was the crowd was always the perfect mix. It was black and white, gay and straight, rich and poor. It was just the coolest of the cool. You'd have the downtown stockbrokers mixing with the sexy uptown Dominicans, who always had the best blow, which they called fish scale. We saw Mike Tyson, Rick James, Michael Jordan, Guns N' Roses, and Eddie Murphy all hanging out at the China Club. Justine texted me recently and reminded me of the time we were at the China Club and she could have gone home with a certain rapper turned underwear model, but didn't. She's still mad at herself for not pursuing it. I am too. I wasn't going after any celebs, though. I was after the DJ. He was a tall, muscular Sicilian with the kind of streetwise swagger that only native New Yorkers can muster. He was an absolute piece. I pointed him out to Justine and said, "He's so sexy to me." "Well, you know him," Justine said. "I don't think so," I said. "No, you know him," she said. "I swear." To this day, I think that Justine was absolutely nuts. At the time, he had recently broken up with the famous penthouse pet named Sandy Korn. She later dated Donald Trump, and he convinced her to change her name to Sandra Taylor. I noticed him way before he noticed me. He had no reason to. I was some skinny, loudmouth kid from the South. He had just gotten out of a relationship with a girl whose poster was on the wall of every horny teenager jerking off in America. I don't remember exactly how, but after seeing him around the club for a while, I eventually ended up with his phone number on a little slip of paper. We had something in common because I was performing and making music and he was playing music at the club. That was the start of the conversation right there. I was 19 and he was 26. Tommy was raised right and he really knew how to treat a woman. His father died when he was young. His mother was in the garment industry, so he helped her with the family business. DJing was just a side gig he started as a teenager in clubs around town, but he kept doing it mostly because he enjoyed it. Like all of my boyfriends, he was very smart. He even skipped a grade because he was so bright. While dating, we were doing all those classic New York activities, going to the theater and museums, walking in Central Park and having dinner in the nicest places. Of course, we were going out to clubs a lot. I kept visiting the China Club every Monday so I could hang out with him. One night he was DJing, and some record executives were in the crowd, as well as a few of Tommy's old DJ friends. He came out to say hi to all of us and then said, you know what? I'm just going to get in the booth and play all old disco shit, just because. He had all of his old records on him from the 70s. He just started playing all the classics that he grew up loving. Everyone in the club fucking lost their minds, and we danced harder and longer that night than we usually did. After about 6 months of dating, I moved in with Tommy. I wanted to take the relationship to the next level, but I was also ready to move out of the loft space over Renee's kitchen. I moved into his apartment in a brick building on the Upper West Side at 100th Street in Amsterdam. The apartment was a recently renovated one-bedroom with a loft over the kitchen, just like the one I was moving out of. While we were living there, I missed a few days of my birth control pills. I thought I could double up on the next ones and it would work out fine. Well, it didn't. My period was late. It dawned on me in acting class while we were doing some exercises. Somebody was performing a boring scene, and for the first time, I wondered if I was pregnant. I didn't feel pregnant, but then again, I had no idea what being pregnant felt like. That afternoon, I went home and took a pregnancy test. It was positive. A few days later, I went to my OBGYN, Dr. Cox, a great gynecologist with the world's most ironic name. She confirmed I was pregnant. I was just kind of fascinated by the news because it didn't even seem like a possibility to me. It was never part of my plan. I'd never really even held a baby before. Being a mother wasn't something that I was thinking about even in the abstract. But from the moment I found out, I knew I was going to keep my baby. In a weird way, I knew he needed to be born. When Tommy got home, I told him the news. He was as surprised as I was, but he was very sweet about it. We decided then and there we were going to get married, start a family, and do right by our child. My mother wasn't nearly as thrilled. Renee had gotten pregnant with me at a young age, and that derailed a lot of her dreams. I think she was upset when she saw the same thing happening to me. Renee said, "This isn't going to work out well. Your life will be changed forever, and I don't think this is the responsible thing for you to do. You should have thought better." She said that once I had a baby, people would look at me like a used car. My grandmother wasn't thrilled either. No one was trying to talk me out of having my son, but they were all giving me their bitter truth that I had a difficult road ahead of me. Tommy and I got married at St. Patrick's Cathedral in Manhattan in December 1991. The wedding was big, obnoxious, and pink. My bridesmaids, who included Trish and Tracy from the girl group The Flirts, with whom I had recorded, wore puffy pink gowns. They were the same color as a Sweet and Low packet. They looked like cupcakes as they walked down the aisle. In hindsight, those dresses were hideous, but mine was gorgeous. At the time, I was doing some modeling for a company called Timeless Bridal. When the bridal boutique buyers came looking for gowns, I would model the product. From them, I bought an incredibly elegant ivory silk gown sprinkled with tiny pink rosettes. It was really classic and had great movement. My grandfather Hollis walked me down the aisle. I even had a beautiful veil with ivory satin trim and a row of matching rosettes across the top. The location was perfect. I'll never forget the sight as I walked from the altar to the doors of St. Patrick's Cathedral on Fifth Avenue, along with having our wedding photos taken in front of the giant Christmas tree in Rockefeller Plaza. We moved apartments again, this time down to Battery Park City at the tip of Manhattan. Tommy's mother lived down there, and with the baby on the way, it made sense. It was a brand new development, so that was where everyone was moving to start families in Manhattan. It was a doorman building at 280 Rector Place, and we were the first people to live in our apartment. It was a one-bedroom, without a loft, finally. When the baby came, he slept in a crib in our bedroom. When I got pregnant, I weighed 118 pounds, about 20 less than I weigh now. For the first time in my life, I started to cook all my own food. I was going to the grocery store every day and making my own pasta, preparing my own salads, and cooking my own meat. I was very disciplined in keeping my diet very healthy for the baby and me. Then on Friday at noon, I would allow myself one small indulgence, a can of Coke and a Snickers bar. When I delivered my son, I was only 128 pounds. When I was pregnant on the subway, no one ever got up and gave me their seat because I didn't look pregnant at all. People were worried that I didn't gain enough weight, but then I delivered a perfectly healthy 6-pound, 8-ounce baby. I would like to take this opportunity to thank my son for not giving me stretch marks on my tummy. My pregnancy was easy, but I did have terrible morning sickness. Once I got it so bad, I had to get off the subway and run to one of the garbage cans on the platform at the 72nd Street station. I barfed out what seemed like just about everything I had ever possibly eaten. I must have been hugging that disgusting can for 15 minutes. Several women walked by and asked me if I was okay. Only someone who had gone through pregnancy would know exactly what that struggle was like. 7 months after my wedding, I was about 2 weeks from my due date. I woke up with a terrible backache. I called my mother and she said, "Erica, you have to call the doctor. This is early labor." I called Dr. Cox and she said, "It sounds like it's happening. You better come into the hospital so we can check it out." I had what is called back labor. The ache was from my son's head pressing on the small of my back. I told Tommy to get a cab to take us from our apartment downtown all the way up to New York Hospital on the Upper East Side. "But in Lamaze class, they said that you should walk around," he told me. "Get me a cab," I said, freaking out a little bit. "No, we're broke and you need to walk around," he insisted. We walked to the 6th train station at Wall Street and took that for what seemed like an eternity to the hospital. No one got up and gave me their seat even then. I was in labor on fucking public transportation. I gave birth to my son at 6 p.m. and it was an easy delivery. He was not crying when he came out. He was just kind of looking around with his big blue eyes, which were sensitive to the light. He was turning his head back and forth as if he was thinking, "Where the fuck am I?" Finally, they smacked him on his pink behind and he started crying. When the doctor put him into my arms, it wasn't like I was meeting a stranger for the first time. I felt like we were two souls being reunited after a long break. Like meeting an old friend. "Oh, hey, there you are," I thought as I held him at the hospital. "Welcome back." We named him Thomas after his father. After he was born, the first phone call I made was to my grandmother to tell her the news. Renee was just across town, but I didn't call her. 25 years later, I think that still bothers my mother. Maybe she shouldn't have called me a used car. Maybe then she would have gotten the first call. As I mentioned, I'd never really held a baby before, but instinctually I knew how to do everything. My mother and grandmother were shocked at how quickly I learned to hold him, swaddle him, feed him, and figure out just what he needed. I loved having the little one. He was so portable. I could just wrap him up and take him out. It helped that my son was a very easy baby. He was never colicky, never fussed much, and was sleeping through the night pretty early. Everything else about life as a young mother wasn't very exciting, though. I had to put my career goals to the side while I was taking care of my baby. Most of my friends from before were still young and more interested in going out than in taking my baby to the park. When we moved to Battery Park City, I was pretty isolated. There was nothing down there except one Gristiti's grocery store, and it wasn't even that good. Some of the sidewalks weren't paved yet because they were still constructing buildings down there. There was just dirt with a rope next to an open space. I'd be walking around with the baby completely by myself. We'd go down to the water, but in the fall and winter, that wind would tear through us, making me miserable and upsetting the baby. Like a sugar cube on your tongue, the girl group I was working with, the Flirts, had dissolved. My bridesmaid and friend Tracy was finally using her economics degree to work with her father, trading semi-precious metals down in the financial district, which was not far from our house. I would walk over to her office, the same office that John D. Rockefeller had, and we would go to lunch. But if the market got hot, I'd have to sit there and wait for her to finish trading, which could take forever. Other than that, I didn't have any friends in the neighborhood. Sometimes, when we would go to the park, other women would ask me, "Oh, who do you work for?" Assuming that because I was so young, I had to be this kid's nanny. I would point to Thomas and answer, "This guy." I would take him out almost every day. Often we'd walk over to the World Trade Center because there was an indoor mall and we could walk around without being stuck in the weather. I can still visualize every step, feature, storefront, and doorman on the walk from our apartment to the World Trade Center. One February day, it was snowing. I decided not to go on our usual walk, but stay inside instead. I was watching TV and holding the baby when I heard a huge explosion. I felt the building sway a little as if the foundation buckled. That was the first bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993. It killed 6 people and injured thousands. The snow was the only reason we weren't in that building that day. The blast was so loud that even at home in my apartment, I could feel its percussion. There were many moments of joy in that apartment. One day when my son was 3 months old, we were sitting on the edge of my bed, and looking at the mirrors that covered the sliding closet doors. I was holding him up and talking to him in baby talk. He looked at our reflection and giggled. It was his first laugh. I know it's awfully cliched, but no sound before or since has ever made me so happy. In general, however, things